This is the second panel focused on improving humanitarian and relief, humanitarian relief and advancing development in Libya. To lead this segment, we are fortunate to have with us a veteran broadcast journalist who's reported from many corners of the globe, including from inside Libya itself. James Bays is editor for Al Jazeera English and hosts two regular programs on the station, Inside Story and Talk to Al Jazeera. We will follow the same format as the first panel and close this segment promptly at 4:25. James will introduce the panelists before then moderating the panel itself. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Bays and his distinguished panel. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. We will follow on and echo and add to some of the themes, I think, from the earlier panel and focus in this panel on the human cost and the way forward to rebuild Libya. And we're very lucky to have a very distinguished panel. I'm just looking above me, and we can't see our Skype guest yet, but I'm sure he's going to pop up high above our heads. But let me introduce the other members of the panel. We have Maria Doval Ribeiro, who is the UN Deputy Special Representative and also the Humanitarian and Development Coordinator in Libya. We will have by Skype Jean-Louis Romanet-Pirot, who's an independent researcher and consultant. He's currently the research team leader for research done by the EU delegation to Libya, which he'll be telling us about. We have Hassan Toule, who's a consultant and former vice president of the World Bank. And we have Tamim Bayo on the other side of me, who is development and international relations advisor and president of a Libya-based education, training and consulting company. Let's start, I think, with the view from the UN, because they're very much in the driving seat at the moment with regard to the political process, but also coordinating the humanitarian situation. And let's start with Maria. And can I start by asking you, how bad is the humanitarian situation in Libya now?
Okay, thank you very much, and thank you very much for this opportunity to be part of this panel, this discussion. Let me start by maybe just quoting from Hassan Salameh's action plan, which he presented at the General Assembly, which he referred to the situation or the political deadlock in Libya. A succession of transitions have failed to bring what Libyans want most, effective and predictable governance and a decent living standards. And in some ways, that's where I'd like to start answering your question. First of all, by saying that if you talk about Syria, Yemen, Central African Republic, many of the countries in sub-Saharan Africa that I've worked in, it is true you look at Libya and you say, is there a humanitarian crisis? The reality is that you do have at the moment 226,000 IDPs, people who are not living in where they would like to live. You have an estimated around 390,000 migrants or people in illicit migration situation needing humanitarian assistance. You also have more seriously, and which goes, not more seriously, but as seriously, which goes with the continuation and perpetration of the lack of political resolution and with the degradation of the economy and many of the issues that were raised in the previous panel in relation to the economy, which is eroding people's salaries. It's eroding basic services, access to water. There's there's very little work being done to maintain water systems, etc. So you have growing needs of ordinary populations. And then you also have to look in relation to migration and just to refer to the situation of migration in Libya to say that Libya has always been a country of in-migration. And, you know, most people actually, even if interviewed by IOM in Italy, a lot of migrants who did cross the Mediterranean said that actually their first port of call was to stay in Libya. And the Libyan economy has always been dependent on the presence of migrant labor. So in addressing the issues of migration, it's very important to address them from the humanitarian side, which we're trying to do as well, in terms of the people who get caught up in an illicit problems of trafficking, of bad conditions and all the rest, and want to return to their homes, but also to look in a more medium term and in terms of the structure of the economy in Libya on what the role of migrant labor is in that context. I wanted to sort of echo as well that if WHO with the Ministry of Health recently did a comprehensive review of all health facilities in Libya, and I just want to give this as an example. And it's fair to say that at 50% or 60% of most health facilities, they may be opened, but they're actually functioning at less than optimal level. So what does that mean? It means that if I'm a woman in Seba and I'm not necessarily going to get assistance for the delivery of my birth, of my baby. There may be a functioning health clinic and all the rest, not sure that the drugs are getting through. Even if there is a budget and there has been an allocation for the Ministry of Health to be able to purchase drugs and all that, but how do you get the money, the value chain to go down the road? So to say that let's not stop at the humanitarian, let's also move towards understanding what causes those humanitarian needs, which we don't want Libya to become a Yemen or a Syria. But if we don't want that, then we have to work with the Libyans at addressing the fundamental issues of building institutions, whether they are at an economic level in terms of addressing the issues relating to the sovereign economic institutions, but also making the governance function so that the kid in the furthest out point of Libya can go and be vaccinated. Thank you.
Well, now I think we'll bring in Jean-Louis, who is on Skype. He is an independent researcher and consultant, but recently did a report for the EU where he was the lead researcher. And I think he's got some interesting analysis on local government, local governance and things at a local level. Jean-Louis.
Thank you. Do you hear me well?
Hear you very well.
Very good. So I second to everything that my predecessor said, and if I may add to that, all this is in a context where institutions are lacking, and there is also a lack of political unity in the country. And therefore, it's very complicated for international actors to address these challenges by engaging with central authorities. The other option is to engage at the local level with other actors, both civil society actors and local governance actors. We've observed a variety of dynamics that have structured, formed themselves naturally in locations in Libya with various success. Some municipalities have been able to provide better services to their citizens. We've just carried out a research for the European Union, which I happen to present tomorrow. The variation is huge, but there are some communities and municipalities that have been able to come together to solve, first of all, the security dilemma, oftentimes even coming to terms with some of the militias in their community, collaborating with civil society organizations, using local media to be able to latch on popular support for local authorities, and provide some sort of security by just people's protection of civil society actors. Nonetheless, the situation remains very complicated. The security is dismal. It's very dangerous for civil society actors to publicly advocate for anything. There are still several kidnappings of activists, individuals, all over the country who may come out against authorities or simply advocate for a model of society that some armed groups may disagree with. compiled with that, if I may insist also on the healthcare crisis, I will expand on the fact that individual citizens do not have access to healthcare simply because they go to the hospital. They have to bring with them everything, a syringe, medications, otherwise they will not get treated. And they have to pay everything out of their own pocket. Libyans, just recently, a friend, a civil society activist in Tripoli, who happens to have her office right by a hospital, had a man come into their office and ask if they had 100 dinars, and he would be willing to leave the car, keys, to be able to get these 100 dinars, to run to the hospital, to get his wife treated. And he called his son to come to Tripoli to be able to bring more money and then recover his car. Because he used all his money just for the diagnostic. And at that point, his wife was very ill and she could have died. But he was desperate. He would have basically given his car and done anything to save his wife. This happened just a few weeks ago. So the healthcare situation is dramatic. And I would have to say that with increased the successful containment of migration is putting extra strain on the system because migrants, some of them are treated in camps by UNHCR and other organizations who are able to access the camps, but not all camps are equipped like that. That means that there is an extra burden on the infrastructure in Libya, which is already lacking to treat Libyans. So I'm afraid that the situation is not going to improve in the near future.
Thank you very much, Jean-Louis. I think now if we can bring in Hassan with his experience working on Libya, but also many other countries as a former vice president of the World Bank. In the first panel, we heard about the problems of the currency devaluation, the liquidity crisis. Give us your thoughts on the economic situation.
Thank you very much. I mean, I think as a backdrop, it's worth considering that when the revolution took place, Libya aimed to create a new compact, a new setting, a setting where citizenry and government had a very different relationship of accountability and transparency and participation. And that vision, what my Libyan friends have called the new model for Libya, I think is a very legitimate aspiration, but it is increasingly diverging from where it is today. So 5 years into the conflict, I think there is an eroding confidence in public authority to be able to deliver security, to be able to deliver basic services, education, health, water, electricity, and to provide a credible vision, a credible alternative as to what the future opportunities for these countries are going to be. So, I mean, I think we're in a very delicate situation in terms of the overall tone that I see with very strong centrifugal forces that are retrenching in that sense. And therefore, I think the duality that we speak of here, and Maria also alluded to it, and Jean-Louis alluded to, the duality and simultaneity of coming to some level of minimum agreement on the economics and the politics so you can, in the first instance, stabilize and reverse the decline and then start transforming the economy into something that is different. Something where the relationship between state and government, the state, the government, and citizenry is very different than the one that has prevailed in the past. So against this backdrop, I mean, the question that I've seen many difficult cases, and when you were speaking on some of them, it reminded me, the scale of the economic and social crisis that is driven by the political strife in Libya is quite staggering. Just you think about the headline numbers. This GDP has probably declined by, we don't really know because the data are very weak, but perhaps as much as 50%. Per capita income is probably one-third of what it was before. Expenditures vastly, vastly exceed revenue. And by that I mean the deficit of Libya is about 60 to 70%. Now, just to give you a sense, I mean, even a country like Egypt who struggles with this is less than 10%. So this is out of the scale. And all the expenditure goes to consumption. It's all going to consumption, no investment, and very little goods and services to pay for the medicines, to pay for the chemicals for the water treatment plant. And all that consumption is mortgaging the future because we're consuming resources, not just of today, but for the future generations. The current account deficit, I mean, I'm not going to go through all of these, but they're staggering numbers. The current account deficit is 30%, and we're financing these through reserves. The financial sector is at a standstill. Even though liquidity has increased to about 60% of GDP, it's a mind-blowing number, there's still a liquidity crisis. Inflation, and we only have estimates for Tripoli, is in the order of about 28%. Now, I go down these lists and I say, you know, if I were a household somewhere in the bled, I really don't care about net foreign asset position or whether the primary deficit is high or low. But it affects the day-to-day life. Electricity today, you have as many as 10 to 12-hour power cuts in the peak demand period. And that's not because there aren't any power plants. It's because we're not able to collect, we're not able to bill, they haven't been maintained. They're having problems to supply the water treatment plants. There's negative pressure in the water system, so the pipes are bursting. The man-made river pipes are bursting. There's a massive wastage, which is impacting waterborne diseases. Diseases that Libya had conquered are coming back. We're getting malaria. We're talking about potential risks of cholera, which is unheard of in a country like Libya. Yeah? So when you think about it from the household perspective, from the community, all that economic crisis is actually translating into their prospects for the living standards on a day-to-day basis. Yeah? 20%, I mean, the data I saw, and the UN data is, 20% of the primary healthcare centers and hospitals are not functioning. And of those that are open, you can perhaps get 60% of the services because there's no staff, there's no supplies, the desalination plants are about to run out of chemicals in a month or two. So there's a fundamental structural issue that needs to be addressed. And so my message here is there's a inaction, indecision will have a very, very significant price. Inaction, indecision is actually taking a decision, making a choice. And it will lead you progressively toward greater, increasing difficulty to put the pieces together again. Because once you start keeping two accounts, two central banks, two economies, two affiliations, increasingly diverse in its horizontality as well as verticality in terms of where they are, local and central, it'll be very hard to put it together. So there's an urgency. There's a need for coherence. We can't do things that aren't coordinated. And third, I think we need to focus on very few real priorities because the, as came out here, the institutional capacity is very, very fragile. The capability of the public institutions has been very fragilized. It's been very fragmented. So I do think that one of the things that has to happen is we need to get everybody around the table to agree to a minimum common program, political agreement and economic agreement, so we can continue to implement things and start stabilizing and reversing the course. Now, let me end with one, if I may. Just I sort of gave this Cassandra story here, yeah? But I actually think, I permit myself to think that Libya has certain advantages if it seizes them. It's only 6 million people. It's literate. It all lives mostly along a coast. It does not have the ethnic religious cleavages we've seen in some other Middle Eastern countries or Afghanistan and so on, or DRC. These are countries and it has wealth. If it is well used, if it is well invested, I think it has a chance to turn this thing around. But time is really running out and it's of the essence. So let me stop here. Thank you.
Tamim, as I come to you, I'm going to read a quotation. I was at a press conference less than a month ago with Maria's big boss, Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General of the United Nations. He was asked, looking at all the crises around the world, which one could he see some hope in? And he said, if you ask me to choose this situation, which I believe progress can be made in the short term, I would select Libya. So hope from the UN Secretary General. Maybe you, Tamim, can tell us whether that's what ordinary Libyans feel.
Well, do I feel the pressure now? Good afternoon. And, you know, the good news for you guys, I'm the last panelist. The bad news for me is everybody has covered pretty much what I'm going to be saying. So I'm going to try to take a different approach to kind of just fill you in into some of the issues that we're talking about from the humanitarian and the development side in thinking and talking about ways to go forward in finding solutions. First, I'd like to join in adding my appreciation to the Middle East Institute for having this conference on Libya, particularly at a time where inexplicably Libya has suddenly fallen off the radar screen in Washington, D.C. So I'm glad to see that Libya is back in conversation and discussion. We ought to look at things, I believe, for today's discussion from the perspective and the lens of the citizen, the Libyan. What are they really dealing with on a daily basis? And you've heard some of the situations that happen as crises for what Libyans deal with, but here are some things that we need to take into account. And if I may, just to kind of change the tone a little bit, ask you to visualize with me an iceberg, if you will. And look at that iceberg and divide that iceberg into three tiers, one top, middle, and a bottom tier. And as we look at that iceberg, I see the top tier of that iceberg, the top one-third, as what I call the daily life basket of the Libyan citizen, the issues that they have to run through and deal with every day. And this consumes the daily life of most Libyans. Long lines at the banks with liquidity and extended salary disbursement delays, repetitive and long power shortages and blackouts. Power shortages affect the operation of water pump stations and cause water shortages as well, just as you heard Hassan say. Gas stations run short on gas supply. Cooking gas cylinders go scarce. Oftentimes, the telephone, cellular systems, and internet also get affected and cease to operate for hours. The exchange rate is 5 to 7-fold the official exchange rate at the bank. Inflation has struck, and prices have been climbing fast. This is the top one tier. Now, this middle tier, I see a healthcare sector in crisis, as you've heard some of the examples and situations that are going on, where hospitals are crying for help for medicine and supplies. Of course, many are also suffering from the shortage of staffing by expats who had left the country due to the security situation. The personal security and safety is also a huge issue, where there is a rise in criminal activity, and in some cities, people can't be safe in the streets or even in their homes. And of course, the long-existing corruption becomes a robust enterprise throughout most sectors in the country. The third tier, and as we get lower on this iceberg, is the closest to the subsurface of that iceberg. And the scope becomes wider now. So we talk about issues that affect, again, the life of every Libyan. Continuous free flow of arms in the country. The state security, issues of terrorism and illegal migration. IDPs, you just heard that over 260,000 Libyans are displaced today, with UN reports also reporting that 2.4 million Libyans are in some need of humanitarian assistance. And the split of the state institutions also causes added obstacles to the daily life of many Libyans. War zones and conflict areas continue to be a cause of distress on many Libyans. For example, innocent Libyan lives continue to perish in the process of demining parts of Benghazi, where mainly because the army does not have equipment to deal with in defusing bombs and mines. You heard that from the ambassador earlier. Innocent Libyan lives under great duress in the city of Derna, where food and medical supplies are scarce. Innocent Libyan lives are paying the ultimate price due to terror attacks unfolding in several cities, and including the recent events in Sabratha as well as the recent unfortunate event that took place yesterday, just yesterday in Misrata. Of course, with the ongoing violence in the southern part of Libya and various cities. Another issue that is causing added burden on the Libyan citizen. Travel. Due to increased costs because of the currency exchange value as well as the scarce cash situation, that's becoming very difficult for Libyans to travel. But also because of the international community has made it extremely difficult and practically impossible for Libyans to obtain travel visas these days. Let's not talk about the U.S. travel ban that has been in the news lately. The disruption in the education and school year calendar has made it difficult for families and their children to carry out their lives in a normal fashion. So all these are issues that are in that bottom tier of that iceberg. Now imagine that iceberg again, and everything we just covered, and these are just a basket of issues, constitute only 10%, because 90% of that iceberg lies beneath that surface. And here, we're talking about issues that we really need to focus on, because, as you know, all these issues are dependent from one tier onto the other and cause added issues that Libyans have to deal with. Number one, the proxy war. Libya has been meddled with by unilateral intervention from regional and international countries since the February 17 revolution. And that's also been undermining the so-called international agreement on having the United Nations carry on its mission in Libya. Two, power struggle. Yes, that is the name of the game on the ground. That is a race to the top to rule. And that is what's going on among Libyans. Three, lack of experience in running state affairs in a new environment of pluralism where rule of law and civilian-run state institutions need to govern. Institutional capacity building is urgently needed in Libya. Hence, more international support is needed. This is also a core element for development to move forward to lead us to the final core issue, what I believe is really the most important issue. The international commitment towards Libya is questionable at best. There is an erosion of belief among Libyans, and that's what's key here. This is through the lens of Libyan citizens, what I'm sharing with you. There is an erosion of belief among Libyans that the international community is not serious about wanting to help Libya stand as a successful and productive nation. The reasons you might ask, well, there has been too many conflicting signals. Lack of political will by the international community to stop the proxy war. It's been mentioned in the previous panel several times in ways how that could be done. Three, 7 years later, and now with the fifth UN Special Envoy, yet the political process has not moved much on the ground in ways that Libyan citizens can feel a positive change in their lives. Four, Libyans' hope was high with the political agreements when it was signed and the formation of the GNA, only for Libyans to find that the GNA was not given the tools and the mandate to be able to make a real difference in their lives on the ground. I believe these underlying issues can be addressed and would impact Libyan lives positively only if the international community steps up to the plate and demonstrates a true and serious commitment to supporting the GNA and the political agreement. Libya needs a little stability and clarity and direction. As for the development front, and I'll just touch on this issue before I close, it is an ongoing and evolving process that requires constant support factors. And those four factors are political stability again, security and relatively low risk environment, and three, a conducive legislative and regulatory environment, and four, an enticing return potential. Well, Libya has the fourth element, but the first three must be achieved. And in order for them to be achieved, there has to be a true partnership with the international community to make those three factors become a reality. Let me wrap up by saying that Libya, with all its perceived problems, remains to be the easiest fix among other conflict nations in the region. Let's not forget that Libya can't actually be a springboard to helping resolve some of the neighboring countries' economic and unemployment problems. Thank you.
Tamim, thank you. Maria, maybe take up one of those points. I know Tamim was mainly talking political when he talked about an erosion of belief in the international community. But in terms of humanitarian and development, perhaps you could give us an overview of what international donors are doing now and how this should look in the future. And possibly address on the humanitarian side. I mean, your figures that I could find said that this year the UN wanted to help almost 1 million people. It was going to cost $151 million. And so far, only $42.9 million, that's 28%, has turned up.
Well, let me start with the good news. We've actually been able to fund the response plan for Libya by 51%.
Ah, good news, yes.
So that is good news. And it actually is above global averages for that kind of response plan. So, and I think that that in itself is interesting, because I'd like to think that some way it reflects a newfound commitment on the part of some donors in being able to provide support for the humanitarian, and also our increased determination to be more present on the ground in Libya, not just in Tripoli, but in other parts of Libya as well, through different programs. So let me just correct as well that the estimate of the population in need of humanitarian assistance for 2017 was actually 1.3 million.
Okay.
That's
still a huge number.
It's still a lot of people. And I mean, it's also how you calculate that, and, you know, what constitutes, humanitarian needs. And so it can also always be debated. But we're talking here about the target group for the UN response plan was 941,000. That doesn't mean that there are only 941,000 people or that we actually know who each of them are, but that it gives an indication of scale and of scale of the impact of situation. And what I can say to you is that as we are now working and preparing on the plan for 2018, that figure has gone up. And this is an agreement not just between the UN agencies and NGOs, but also organizations such as the ICRC and the Red Crescent Societies as well, that there is an increasing concern of the impact. This is where I would like to say that, to go back to what Hassan was saying, the time is of the essence. There isn't much time left. And there isn't actually, in some ways, there's a need to have an increase in support in key areas, whether in the economy or basic services, which allow the situation not to deteriorate and to at least create the conditions by which, once there is a political agreement, that Libya can move forward towards a new economy and a new society that it wishes to build. But just say, some of the focus maybe of the work that we're doing in Libya on the humanitarian, it is mainly in the area of health, health services, education, water and sanitation. We've heard some of the issues about water. I have a figure that the man-made river is in danger of losing 60% of its supply. That's a figure I've heard recently, of its capacity. There's a large part of the population of Tripoli that depend on the man-made river for water. So we need to look at innovative solutions, but also on being able to ensure. One of the big issues that you can respond to the humanitarian needs. You can provide essential drugs. You can run vaccination campaigns. But you also need to do something about the health system that is not functioning. And in some ways, in the donor support that we get, that always isn't, that's not always evident. And sometimes it's easier to get for one than for the other. And in some ways, as the, my boss, Secretary General, said in his opening statement at the high-level event, was the need for predictable funding for humanitarian and development activities in Libya. Having said that, I think also one of the areas that we are engaging very much and with, in partnership with the World Bank and the European Union, with the Libyan authorities, discussion on the Libyan contribution to also financing of these programs. And we have, for example, recently received a pledge from the GNA government of $5 million towards the stabilization facility, which is managed by UNDP at the moment. But that discussion is not just a medium-term discussion. It's an immediate one about which is linked to the management of the funds, of the money that is there, and how to work, how to support the GNA and the government and the authorities in Libya in actually beginning to fix some of the economic public financing issues that exist in the country. What I would say, you know, and that obviously on the stabilization capacity building that agencies such as UNDP is working very closely on capacity building in terms of the public service as well and looking at very specific areas, UNICEF on education, as well as obviously the work that Human Rights, UNHCR, and other agencies are working on the rule of law and questions related to the justice system as well. So we try to have a mix, but one of the big questions we have is a lack of predictability of funding, and secondly, the whole question of access that, as was pointed out, we must be careful not to contribute towards a further fragmentation of Libya. And that implies a capacity to be present, and not only to be present, but to engage with Libyans at different parts of the country. Thank you.
And, of course, the international community now is back in Tripoli in part, but a lot of operations still being run from Tunis. Hassan, maybe I'd ask you to add to some of Maria's points as the international community starts to move more people into Tripoli and into Libya. Are there any pitfalls to avoid from your experience?
Well, I mean, I, having retired from the World Bank, I speak on behalf of no one except myself, right?
So, your personal experience.
I do think it's important to constantly underline that the solution. I agree that external players and partners that meddle in Libya, including the non-traditionals who meddle through various sorts of interference, need to be brought to the court of public opinion and managed better, clearly. But that being said, I think ultimately, unless there is a coming together, not an agreement on everything to the nth degree, a coming together on the part of the Libyans, no amount of external interference, money, capacity, training will change and solve this thing. I mean, my experience from many parts of the world in this is you simply cannot do that unless there is a willingness to make compromises and come together on a minimum package. No? And I mean minimum. There'll be lots of issues to discuss. What extent do we decentralize this or the other? But do we agree that we want to have a unitary state where certain functions are managed collectively? Do we agree that the rent, the extractive rent resources are going to be managed as a collective, or is there, those are fundamental issues. I don't think we, whose future, we will not live the consequences of these, so it has to come from the Libyans. So I really want to underline that point. There are things that I think is important. While it is understandable that there's a humanitarian urgency, nobody wants to see people suffer for year after year. But on the other hand, if we only deal with the humanitarian and do not deal, as Maria rightly pointed out, by creating a durable primary healthcare system, tomorrow you'll be back providing the same diabetic drugs, the same vaccinations, And then you create a pattern of dependency which does not make of Libya the kind of Libya that people aspired to at the time of the revolution. So I think what I would point out is don't treat the symptoms only. You have to deal with the acute symptoms, but you have to deal with the causes, which is what brings me back to areas where I used to, once upon a time, have a competence, which was on the economic area. If you do not get to the point where you realign your public finance, your public expenditure, get on top of the anti-corruption and transparency issues, deal with the armed people and the militias, you will simply be bleeding and constantly be running for additional money. And whether there's presence in Libya or outside, materially won't affect it as much as making sure that we can agree on whatever that core package is. And I'm happy to elaborate on any of those issues, but I do think that we have to constantly bear in mind is we need to fix the causes that led to this, and the causes predate the crisis often. They go back, the roots of these go back into the previous regime. I mean, as we talk about rebuilding a state, we almost should be talking about building a state. We need to create institutions, not recreate institutions. You know, so that we can advise, give our lessons, give practices, provide some financing, but it has to come, in fine, from the Libyan parties.
Now, not all the questions are from me. We'll be opening it up in about 15 minutes to the floor, so please be thinking of your question. As I go back to Jean-Louis, you mentioned in your opening remarks the fact that, yes, we have a humanitarian crisis involving Libyans, but on top of that, you have the humanitarian crisis as a result of those trying to transit Libya. And I think some rather interesting statistics on the numbers coming in and out of Libya in recent months seem to be record figures for the early part of the year, and then suddenly the numbers seem to have gone down in July and August, and certainly some reports suggesting that money is now being paid to militia to stop people coming. I wondered your perspective on this, Jean-Louis.
This one is the easy topic that is frustrating anybody. So since I don't work for anybody, an independent consultant, I guess I'll take some strong stance. It appears to me that Libya does not have a migration crisis. Europe has a migration crisis. Europe needs to help itself to manage the migration challenge and opportunity rather than externalizing it on Libya. Libya has its own humanitarian crisis, and everything that we're doing right now to curtail the flow of migrants from Libya to Europe is a very short-term stopgap measure. We can speculate that it would be for political reasons, since we have elections coming up soon in some European countries, some have already passed, is putting stopping a sink from evacuating water, but we're not closing the faucet. I just recently spoke with friends in Kufra and Sabha, and they told me that despite the fact that less migrants are leaving the shores of Libya, the number of migrants coming through the south has remained the same. So it's becoming a pressure cooker. You can imagine what will happen out of this pressure cooker. The only effect in the short term has been the increase in price demanded on migrants to actually transit Libya and reach the shores, which is counterintuitive. Now, another thing that I'd like to point out is the numbers. There is very little information on Libya, on what goes on in Libya. We're talking about the humanitarian crisis, and I respect all the numbers that Maria and Tamim have shared earlier, which are the best numbers that we have. But as a researcher looking at Libya since 2011, I am quite skeptical, and I put a great deal of scrutiny on the numbers that we have. Despite the fact that they are the best that we are getting, the quality of the numbers, the quality of the statistics, the quality of information that we have is at best approximative. And I'm afraid it's under evaluating the problems. How many people are in need in Libya, whether it is 1 million or 2 million, All I can say is that many things are largely invisible to us. We don't have access. We rely on local partners, which we cannot even train in Libya. Young researchers in a country where statistics, research, surveys were not done for 42 years, where the Department of Political Science was under the Department of Economy, and they were studying the Green Book. Doing research in a country like that is it's very complicated. So I just want to say to have a great deal of scrutiny on the numbers and on the statistics and on the reports that have come out of Libya, particularly when they're not written by Libyans and framed by a strong methodology. In terms of the overall picture, I also wanted to react on something that Tamim said, and I wish I could share your optimism. My optimism actually comes from somewhere else, and I'll maybe address that later. But allow me to be a little more, not pessimistic, but to lay out the challenges. I honestly do not think that Libya is a quick fix and that is an easy country to redress. What I believe is that Libya is an open laboratory. That I believe, and I don't know if this is what Secretary General Guterres intended. An open laboratory means that everything can happen, and potentially even quickly. But does it mean that we'll have a stable and democratic Libya? I am skeptical of that for a simple reason, that unlike other contexts, Libya is facing three major challenges at the same time, which is state building, democratization, and market liberalization. Not many countries have gone through these three challenges at the same time. These are huge challenges. Why I say Libya is a laboratory? It's a laboratory because Libyans have to decide, in order to do state building, they need to decide on the blueprint of the governing institutions that they want to have. They need to equip themselves with a constitution, which hasn't happened yet. Inshallah, we will have a vote in the coming year with a blueprint. Only with a blueprint that is agreed upon by the Libyans, we can move forward with that. Democratization rests on people buying in democratic institutions. Well, we've seen that people are falling out of love for democracy after the uprising, which is very saddening, because after the first parliament, they didn't see the fulfillment of the expectations that they had during the uprisings. And so you see that the turnout went from almost 50% to 15% in the last election, right before the second eruption of conflict in Libya. And in terms of market liberalization, if you look at Libya, the oil, to me, is not an asset for Libya in terms of fiscal sociology. When the bulk of state income doesn't come from the workforce of the people, but rather from the soil, it doesn't bode well for the construction of democratic institutions because the state can basically bypass people. It doesn't mean that it can happen and doesn't mean that new models cannot emerge in Libya. And actually, my optimism comes precisely from the people. I work very closely with Libyan activists, and I see that the future of Libya is in the hands of women and youth, which have been disenfranchised before, and that now have an opportunity to play a role. The future of Libya is in the hands of economic and social entrepreneurs, which are coming up with very crafty ideas to solve Libya's challenges. But I'm afraid that it's complicated. I'll conclude my comment about the international intervention. I always tell my Libyan friends that they should be careful about what they ask for. We just had a two-day event with Libyan activists, with the European Union, and some Libyans were saying, first, you need to solve the security problem. You need to take weapons out of the militias, and then you can support civil society. Does Libya need to become a protectorate like Iraq after the allied intervention, largely American? I'm not sure that Libyans want that, and I'm sure that there is any appetite for that. Can external actors solve the security problem? I'm not sure about that. So, unfortunately, it's largely in the hands of Libyans to come up with solutions which may come up at the local level and then maybe in a reverse process form institutionalized at the central level. Italy can resemble, Libya can resemble Italy of the 15th century, a series of quasi-city-states, possibly learning how to live together. And for the international community, the challenges I see right now are mainly to engage with Libyans, to figure out what policy is best fit together. There is very little dialogue and not enough engagement. It's very difficult to access. But the second one is also to monitor and evaluate the programs that we're running, because we have nobody on the ground, and therefore the money we spend are not necessarily achieving the goals that we expect, and the information is not feeding back up. And that is a problem, and this is something that Libyans tell me on a daily basis. And the last problem is a fund transfer. It's becoming incredibly difficult now to transfer cash to Libyans. If I decide to support a program which is a really, really valid program, let's say a social entrepreneurship incubator in Tripoli, like a young man told me yesterday he wants to do. I told him, I'll do my best. But how are we going to transfer cash? The banking system doesn't work. We mentioned the problem earlier. Now there are new credit cards issued to Libyan families, but they're still very problematic to use. The Hawala system is one system, but it's very complicated to actually get support to Libyans, let alone the role that intelligence services are starting to play in the scrutinizing whichever international money gets to Libya. So I'll stop at that. I think I've mentioned many aspects.
You have. Hassan, I know that you wanted to come back quickly, and I say quickly because I want to go to the floor in a moment, on the issue of migration.
I mean, the only point I was going to make is, and I think we touched on it, and I feel it's very important that we not forget that for more than 5 years, despite insecurity, despite collapsing services, despite loss of livelihood and incomes, local Libyan host communities took care of IDPs and took care of migrants and refugees. I find it at best inappropriate that when the migrants start hitting the shores of some of the other countries, that we start giving priority and exclusivity even to the refugees. It has to be dealt with as a systemic issue. Providing capacity to the Libyan host communities that also accommodate the IDPs and also accommodate the migrants, because before the crisis, many of those people, I also worked in Niger in the south, many of the people who are currently migrants used to get employment and work in Libya. So, you know, I really think that you cannot, one of my leitmotifs is symptoms versus causes. You got to fix this thing systemically, because otherwise you're putting Band-Aid and you're going to be running out of Band-Aid. So I the point that Jean-Louis is making is a fundamental one. You have to deal with this thing not just as an isolation, but the broader systems and sort of healthcare system, water system, electricity. That is the solution that has to be brought. So let me stop there.
I would like to see if either Tamim or Maria would like to come back on one other point of Jean-Louis, which is this stop of the flow of refugees that we've seen. It may just be a blip in the last few months. He referred to it potentially being a pressure cooker. We've seen abuse of migrants. The High Commissioner for Human Rights, Prince Zaid, said he was appalled at the horrific abuse migrants face after being intercepted, extrajudicial killings, slavery, torture, rape. That seriously must be a concern. Would either of you like to?
Well, it certainly is a concern, but let's also keep in mind, just like Hassan said, I mean, we have to treat the issues from the root causes. And if the system is broken, you can't expect but to have these kind of problems emerge with refugees or other things. So we need to really, truly look at ways of how to help Libya stand on its feet so it can address the issues that it needs to address that include illegal migration. Let's keep in mind, we just talked about hundreds of thousands and over a million Libyans that are desperately in need of help as well. So as far as Libya is concerned, not only cannot do this on its own, the illegal migration, but it's an international problem that must be addressed together. And it brings me back to the point I was saying earlier, the international community has a responsibility to stand up seriously to help Libya resolve this issue as well as other issues from the root problems. I would not take more time.
I'd like to get your thoughts, Maria, on the migration crisis very briefly. I also want to take questions from the floor shortly, so show of hands, please, so I know where I'm going, and I'm going to come out and stand next to you and take your questions in a moment after we've heard Maria and anything she wants to follow up with on migration.
Just on the actual figures and whether there are less people crossing, or does that mean that people are getting stuck inside Libya? I think at the moment we actually don't have any evidence either ways, and we don't. I think we have to wait and see what the trend is over the next couple of months to see that. If they are getting stuck in Libya, then I do recognize that there, we have a pressure cooker situation. Because also, going back to what Hassan was referring to, that many of these people, most of the illegal migrants or the migrants, they're not in detention camps, they're not caught trying to cross. They're actually living in different parts of Libya and in different host communities that are actually also under pressure as well. So the pressure cooker, I think, is there either ways, regardless of whether there's a stem in the flow or not. I also would like to say that, you know, I think it's very important what was said already in many ways, is that as an international community, as partners of humanitarian or development, that we actually also know how to engage with each other so that we are engaging with Libya in a more coherent way. It doesn't mean we have to agree on everything or that, you know, we all have different competencies and capacities, but I think we should avoid, be careful not to sort of create a shopping options situation, but rather to engage with the Libyans on discussing what are the real issues and what are the competencies and what is this, to unpack what assistance is. Because I'm not sure it's not about money necessarily, and I think there has to be a much broader discussion. I just want to say.
Can you hear me now? Yeah, there we go. We'll take questions from the floor. I will, if you can make it known, I will try and get through as many as possible. If you keep your questions short, questions not statements, and please identify yourself. Sir.
My name is Michael Alban. I'm an independent researcher. My questions are to Jean-Louis and Mr. Tamim regarding the tribes at the grassroots level. Are there reconciliation events between tribes locally? I'm talking about tribes now, not necessarily militias, in the eastern as well as the western part of the country. And if so, what is the role of sheikhs or tribal leaders in brokering their people's access to the government services that are so difficult of access? Thank you.
Jean-Louis.
Thank you. My answer is going to be a bit articulated, so bear with me. Tribes are an asset for Libya to the extent that we understand the limitations that tribes have. First of all, tribes are strong and have tractions and therefore ability to solve conflict in some locations in Libya, not in others, particularly in the eastern part and some in the south. But they have their limitations. Oftentimes there are providing stopgap measures based on their authority and diffusing conflict for a very short period of time. And what we've seen since 2011 is that these conflicts keep on relapsing and re-emerging time after time because the root causes are not addressed for a series of reasons. So in terms of conflict resolution, tribes as well will have to become creative, more inclusive. We've seen some new models developing, oftentimes they're called social councils, Majlis Ijtimai. They exist in the Nafusa Mountains where the Amazigh reside and in some parts in Sabha or in the surrounding areas. So a variety of councils are now playing an important role. And sorry if I advertise it, but if you want to, you know, learn about these I will, you know, share this report, which is public, which is an analysis of six municipalities across Libya, written by Libyans, six Libyans and myself. I only provided the methodology and wrote one of the reports, but I wanted Libyans to write it, so I recruited Libyans to write them. And you would see there that in some localities, various local actors came together to address the issues, and they were successful. Zuwara is an example. In Zuwara, they even stopped migration. No migration from Zuwara for 2 years now. Unprecedented and unlike anywhere else in Libya. So I hope that this answers your question.
Thank you. Our next question.
My name is Deyarwejde. I'm from Syria. I'm maternity.
Sorry. You'd like to respond?
Real quickly, if you don't mind.
Yeah, of course.
I think there are two things that need to be mentioned here. The tribal elements in Libyan society historically has always played a positive role, just as Jean-Louis has said, in the social aspect. When the state had fallen, that became a safety net, if you will, for Libyans to try to resolve their issues through the tribal system. However, we have to be very clear on our direction. Do we want to build a state, a modern state with institutions and law and order, or do we want to go through a tribal way? So we have to be careful in what we infuse into the equation and making sure that we don't give wrong signals, because that's, again, conflicting signals to the Libyans. If we want to have rule of law, if we want to have institutions, if we want to have a modern state, then we have to go down that path. And the tribes have never been and will not be seeking to have a political role, so to speak, in that formula. Thank you.
So your question. So
my question to Mr. Hassan. All the problems actually interrelated with development, security problems, disarmament, people like they don't have jobs, they carry weapons. My question to you, after working for the World Bank, being on the board with IREX and so many international NGOs, we have also now seen all people criticizing the local community of Libya. But in the meantime, you have been focusing on the importance of Libyan participating and making decisions. In practice, actually, we have in Syria and so many models, Iraq, $18 billion from the international community and the U.S. invested 65% of them non-documented money. They did not develop the country. They left the country behind for sectarianism. So what recommendation do you have for us, for international, for the elite who claim the right to educate people and tell them how to build their country? Thank you.
Before you answer, Hassan, can I just have another show of hands of those who want a question? Right, Hassan.
Well, I mean, it's a very good point. I mean, first of all, I think we need to be very conscious at all times of the weak institutional capacity or the weak capacity of the public institutions to execute some of these programs. I often said that one of the biggest risks is when the international community, in all of its goodwill, decides we're going to start opening the money. And then there's no capacity to absorb, there is no ability to supervise the projects, and money disappears into the woodwork. Okay, we've seen this over and over again. Libya, just to give you another example, has 20,000 legacy projects, probably in the order of 100, 150 billion Libyan dinars. Some are complete, some are incomplete, some have no pre-feasibility studies, some have had no legal tenders. All these issues have to be brought together. Therefore, one of my messages that I hope I underlined is that, one, be very, very focused on very few priorities. Don't try to do 550 things together. There are things that have to be done immediately, and you recognize there are other important things to be done. They're not unimportant, but you have to deal with them later. You cannot deal with everything at the same time. Okay? Number two, there has to be discipline, and discipline on the part of the international parties and communities. If everybody decides they're going to work with this community or that hospital or with this power plant, and there is no integrated system approach, tomorrow we will find ourselves in the same situation. I mean, I remember in Haiti, everybody ran in. Every community said, I will support this school, I will support this healthcare center. Nobody looked at the medicine drug supply chain. Nobody looked at whether the teacher training and curriculum was integrated. Nobody knew whether once the community of donors disappeared, that could be supported locally. Okay? So, I mean, I think it requires discipline on both sides. And it's very hard. because everybody wants to do good. And in doing good, we're going to probably expose ourselves so that discipline, and something that came out here. My experience, there is no better moment for corruption than reconstruction. Because everybody wants to rebuild. Okay? Do you actually have in place mechanisms, a national tender board? Do you have audit boards? Do you have supervising engineers? Do you have a local community accountability that the service is delivered? So we need to go in measured steps, but if we do it, I think you can stabilize, then start reversing it, and then third, you could probably start the transformation that I think Libyans want.
Let me stop there. A couple more questions, sir.
Thank you very much for the excellent panel. My name is Hisham Jabi. I work at Tetra Tech in Washington, D.C. My question is related to young people and how much the international community is paying attention to the youth bulge. Of course, it's across Middle East. We know that. But particularly in Libya, when you have 55-plus of the population are young people. And as we all know that, youth sense it. If you do not treat them as an asset, and if you look at them as a liability, so that providing programs to bring young people with sense of belonging and just work with them, not for them, turn them from being victim into leaders, because they are agent for change and they are the best assets that Libya and even the Middle East have, but it depends how we relate to them and how we work with them. I'm very curious to know what do you think of that.
Marie, would you like to take that one?
Yeah, I mean, I can take it by saying that I agree 100%. I think somebody said earlier on that women and youth are the two key actors in Libya. Women, they represent over 50% of the population, and youth, as you said yourself, it depends on how you define youth, actually, what age you stop at youth. Somebody in Libya actually said it was up until 49, but I'm
generous.
Not sure. That's, I think, because he was 46. So, but just to say, I think you're right, but not only in terms of the asset and the future of Libya, but I would say in terms of also today, because if you don't have opportunities, if you don't create opportunities and confidence that young people that they have opportunities and that they have a future, then what are the options for them? And when you are talking about a country which has militias, which has all sorts of other issues as well, then, you know, does that become the only option? I would often sort of illustrate as well in terms of the economy of the south of Libya, of trying to understand what are the enabling factors which make it that actually young people find it more attractive to be traffickers and members of militias than they do necessarily to do another job. And I think we need to be able to start understanding that. Empowerment as well, but also as Libya designs programs, economic programs and all the rest, to actually factor in what impact is this going to have on young people? Is this creating new opportunities for young people or not? So I think it's very important.
I'll try and get two more questions in, madam.
Hi, my name is Anne Rutherford, and it sounds like Libya is ready to fall apart. And I was just wondering, it had a structure in place. There was a functioning country there. You took Gaddafi out. Why did it fall apart so badly? And on the other end, you're trying to put in a government, a state government that they have never known.
Tamim?
I'll try to take a stab at that. I think it's very important to recognize, and I think it was mentioned earlier in the panel, that Libya has been a fallen state for the past 42 years before the February 17 revolution. The only thing that this February 17 revolution did, it brought that to the surface. There was no state beforehand. We had a one-man show that ran everything, and we thought that there was a state, or it gave the perception to some countries and some people that there was a state, but there was no state. So as Hassan also mentioned earlier, we're not recreating, we're not rebuilding, we are creating. So that just goes to show you that there has never been really true state institutions in the country. And that's going to require time, and that's going to require investment, and that's going to require help. And that brings us back to what I've been saying. You know, we don't, Libyans don't have the experience. If, you know, 42, 43 years, add 7 years to it, we're talking about half a century where Libyans don't know what state institutions are, don't know what rule of law is, don't know. So we have to adopt a new way of thinking to be able to instill these. And that's the good news, that we can do that now. The important thing is, what is our commitment as an international community to making sure that we stay true to the values of the revolution, that the people went and created this revolution and paid the ultimate price for, having freedoms, having a modern state, having a rule of law, having a constitution. It's important that we make sure that our commitment is to that. It's not just to some quick solution to just render some stability that could be at the expense of the big values that Libyans saw and wanted and so expressed in their outing on the February 17 revolution.
James, can I just say one anecdote? Just to piggyback on this, I think what Libya is attempting to go through is a very profound cultural change, a shift in the fundamental norms. Yeah? Before, you had a very strong security apparatus, you had a one-man show, you maybe had a decent central bank and national oil company. But the other institutions were all directives from the top. I was in a conversation recently and with some Libyan colleagues, and what really struck me is if we're going to get to a society where initiative is valued, where risk-taking is valued, where the youth is liberated to undertake activities, you need to get into a mindset where there's a French expression which says, ce qui n'est pas autorisé est interdit. That which is not authorized is forbidden. From that mindset, where you need specific permission to do something, to a negative list where you say, unless it's specifically forbidden, you're free to take initiative. And that's a very hard shift to make. I mean, you get into a very legalistic sense. And that, I think, is you need to create that enabling infrastructure for where people are willing to take risk because there's no specific restriction for them to do so, as opposed to wanting permission to do so. You see? That's a big haul. It's doable, but it's a big haul.
Your question.
I'm sorry, I have two. Sorry. First, I'll be quick, though. Jean-Louis, I'm curious about European efforts to, and I'm going to use the word empower, localized communities or municipalities, to empower local municipalities to deal with the migration issue. From my perspective, it would seem obvious that in doing that, the actors that are responsible for trading in migrants would end up double dipping. So they would take money from the migrants, paying them for transfer, and then, you know, if localities are getting paid by the Europeans to actually contain them, that there would be some sort of deal making going on between them. So I was just wondering if that's a possibility, because it seems to me that that would be. Secondly, I'm wondering, when we're having this discussion, when we're talking about the international community, which international community we're talking about. Because it seems from based on my experience that it tends to fall, the burden tends to fall in Western countries. And so, you know, as we all know, there are plenty of Gulf actors involved in Libya too. You know, and I wonder, without naming any in particular, if it would be better spent to put money into hospitals instead of hangars in Eastern Libya.
Jean-Louis, if you take the first question.
Yeah. To my knowledge, the European Union is not supporting any individual municipality directly to curtail the flow of migrants. I'm now in a very tough spot because I'm French-Italian. And the problem is with policies that actually France and Italy are actually engaging in to try and solve a problem which is at odds with a policy that is the European Union engagement in Libya, which is a long-term engagement. These are could be entering in collision. Direct engagement with local actors for the specific purpose of tackling migration I think is a strategy for disaster, both in Libya and abroad. It's a boomerang politically. It will be a liability at the humanitarian level. I hope the reality would prove me wrong, but I won't hold my breath. In terms of support, actually the European Union is among probably the largest donor to support a very large program to rebuild infrastructure and to support localities, to spearhead economic development, not to stop migration by stopping the flow at the shores, but actually increase the absorbing capacity of municipalities over the medium to long term by investing dozens of millions of euros which have already been allocated, and the program has already been running, and I'm sure Maria can tell more about this, through UNDP and GIZ. I hope that this answers your questions. There is no direct support to tell municipalities, please stop migrants, on behalf of the European Union. No. The European Union is supporting civil society, it's supporting entrepreneurship, it's supporting local governance, participatory, it supports women empowerment. Not because I'm advocating that the European Union is the best, other actors are trying to do the same. So I'm just worried when I see policies that are targeting only a single issue, especially when that's migration.
Maria, if you'd like to pick up from there, maybe, and answer the second question.
I agree with 100% of what Jean-Louis is saying, and I think we were saying that as well, and also that it's my understanding that the European Union has indeed tried to design a more holistic support towards migration through the Trust Fund for Migration. Having said that, there are European policies which are not necessarily the European Commission as such, but I won't go into that here. What I would like to just give as an example, when you talk about who the burden of donors falls on, just give the example of the stabilization facility, which is managed by UNDP. And stabilization facility is about actually providing a tool of delivering services within the framework of the GNA government. And it is about initial, immediate, basic infrastructure in places like that have been more affected by the political crisis. And it's made up of a number of donors, and they're not all from the West. I'm not going to go into every single one of them, but I can assure you that it is a pretty good spread. Most of them are the traditional donors, but there are some non-traditional donors as well.
Maria, thank you, and thank you to an excellent panel this afternoon, second excellent panel here in Washington, D.C., and in Tunis. And Jonathan has some closing remarks.
Thank you very much. Please. I learned a lot today. I hope those in attendance, everyone here also did. With freedom comes responsibility. And when it comes to Libya, Libyans are, for better or worse, in the end, responsible for their own fate. But the rest of the world, everyone else with an interest in Libya, needs to be on their side and aligning together. Because when Libyans are played off by international actors, that's not good for Libya. Libyans need our united, fully aligned support. When I was in my job as special envoy, I had the privilege of working with all the members, permanent members of the UN Security Council on Libya, and there was tremendous alignment. And without such alignment, an alignment by Morocco and Algeria at the same time, and Egypt and Qatar and Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Jordan and the Emirates, we would not have had the Skhirat Agreement. Libyans would not have been able to achieve it. So alignment's very important. Maria has an incredibly difficult, demanding job. There's so much reconstruction that needs to be done. There have been very practical suggestions on the economy, on security, and as we can see, the political framework agreement is potentially moving forward. I raised the question of whether Libya could be a good news story still. I almost blushed when I said it. Has he suddenly become naive and idealistic? No, I have hope. I do have hope for Libya. There are a lot of really fine people in Libya doing their best and wanting to see their country emerge from the confusions and problems since the revolution. So with that as a summation, on behalf of the Middle East Institute, I wish to thank Garter World Federal Services, a corporate member of MEI, for its support in making this conference possible. I also note that this event would not have happened without many hours of work by people, some of whom are on site today. Please join me in a round of applause for the MEI staff and interns who organized this conference, including Jessica Agnes Delini, Scott Zuki, Alina Abutaleb, Najla Suderi, Megan Giovannetti, Mary Yavari, and Christine Iyer. I thank all of you in particular. MEI is grateful to the expert speakers who participated and to you, our audience, for your thoughtful and provocative questions. Thank you for attending. Let's do this again sometime. Bye-bye.